you talk about the true costs of war, and something military planners should recognize is something that I found most fascinating about your book was this idea that soldiers almost unconsciously were resisting this stress and in the end resisting the war effort in Vietnam. How did that all come about?
I think that, well, part of it was the draft. And when soldiers were, this is a different kind of an army now, but the soldiers that were in Vietnam, at least until 71, were drafted. And a lot of them were drafted in spite of their opposition to the war. And initially, before 1969, there was a lot of expressed opposition in sort of quiet, acceptable, sort of semi-acceptable ways. Combat avoidance, you know, making up excuses to get out of missions or to be sent to the rear. But from 1969 on, combat avoidance was increasingly replaced with outright mutiny. In August of 1969, the banner headline of the New York Daily News said, "Sir, my men refused to go." An entire company refused a direct order, which was theoretically punishable by death, to advance down a road that they thought was unsafe. That was the first reported incident, but they, from 69 on, those incidents multiplied, and desertion was a further indication of the level of dissent. A quarter of all GIs went AWOL from the Vietnam Army, some for weeks, some for years. In 1971 alone, 100,000 soldiers deserted. And then there was much more chaotic stuff like fragging, the use of a fragmentation device, usually a hand grenade, to kill unpopular officers. Somewhere between 20 and 25% of all the officers who died in Vietnam were killed by their own men. And, I mean, they were putting bounties on unpopular officers' heads. And I think when Nixon realized how unreliable his army was, he was forced to come up with the face-saving strategy that he called Vietnamization, where he could pull unruly ground troops out and turn the war over, supposedly turn the war over to the Vietnamese, but really turn it over to the Navy. And then resistance exploded in the Navy. From 70 to 72, there were fires and engine sabotage and riots and mutinies. In 1972, there were 5 sabotaged aircraft carriers out of commission in San Diego Harbor, millions of dollars worth of damage. And an open revolt on the USS Constellation that the New York Times called the first mass mutiny in the U.S. Navy. And then the Air Force followed suit. They started in 73 when Nixon continued to secretly bomb Cambodia after he'd signed the Paris Peace Accords. Airmen started refusing to fly bombing missions on principle. And when they were court-martialed, they turned around and sued the Pentagon. And their arguments were upheld all the way to the Supreme Court, at which point the government dropped the charges. Nixon really didn't have very much choice but to withdraw. I think it's really interesting that from here, after having done the research for this book, I really believe it was American soldiers who essentially defeated the American army. And the other really fascinating piece of that, for me, was that their rebellions were reported on the front pages of mainstream papers and magazines from 69 to 73. And I think it's fascinating, and I'm including myself in this, it's fascinating how few people remember.
So this is the unspoken part of American military history, even though it was right in front of us, sort of hiding in plain view.
Hiding in plain view, yeah.
Hiding in plain view, and also eclipsed by the new headlines and the new war that we're experiencing now. You know, we talk about all of these parallels, and I know the fighting force is different, and we do have a different army today. But also, a part of your book talks about the root of this problem, the idea of people going beyond a sense of what's right in their own psyche, a sense of what is right and wrong, and doing things that they know essentially are wrong and then having to live with it, I guess. This is something that happens, we see it happening in Vietnam, we see the effects of it now, we can study it and talk to people, but now today these things are happening on the streets of Iraq and Afghanistan, and new soldiers are facing the idea of what's right and what's wrong, And we're also finding out in mainstream news that many of them are choosing to do what's wrong. How do we give soldiers, is there a way to give soldiers a set of moral values, excuse me, that can allow them to make decisions in a time of war that won't put them in the realm of PTSD?
That's a really good question. I think that, you know, the American psychiatrists, military psychiatrists, came out of the wars of the 20th century understanding that there are two things that really damage soldiers. The first is that soldiers fight for love, not hate, and that's not love of country. They're fighting for the guy next to them and the guy that they can trust. They call that unit cohesion, sorry. And the second one is that if it's bad enough for long enough, anyone's going to fall apart. Doesn't matter how strong you are, how brave you are. There's just no such thing as a bulletproof mind. So during Vietnam, they kept soldiers in country for just a year, hoping that a year would be a manageable amount of time for a soldier to withstand the stress of combat. But then in the interest of efficiency, they decided to ignore the first rule about unit cohesion. So after basic training, soldiers were inserted individually into the war machine according to some entirely bureaucratically efficient system that ignored the relationships that they'd established during their training. So they're sent into terrifying situations surrounded by strangers. So maybe it was the limited amount of time that soldiers spent in Vietnam that was the reason there were so few psychiatric casualties in country. There were only about 1%, which was much better than previous wars. But the ways in which it undermined unit cohesion was surely a major cause of the PTSD they came home with. And I don't know if you've noticed or not. I'm sure you've noticed. But at least so far, all you hear about from Iraq is that the morale of the troops is still high. It's starting to change now, but for a long time, that was all you heard. They're keeping the units together now, but they're ignoring the time intensity rule. So soldiers are being kept in the combat zone way beyond the generous limits that even the Army considers safe. Some of these kids have been deployed 3 times in as many years. So this time, the problem isn't morale, but they've exhausted the psychic resources of these soldiers. It seems that almost every day now, there's a new report of a rape or a murder or some other atrocity committed by American soldiers, decent kids who are they're predictably out of control. This isn't an aberration. It's happened before. And I have no doubt that it's going to continue to happen as long as the policymakers get away with declaring themselves judgment-proof.
Now, the powers that be would say that we will always need soldiers and we will always need an army and we'll always need people to have to deal with this. But your book calls for an end to war. Is this something in the year 2006 that is feasible?
The book calls for an end to war. And what I'm talking about isn't an end to violence. But war has become so normed in our culture that we simply take it for granted. People think that it's part of human nature, and the next sentence is, so there's nothing I can do about it, and eyes glaze over, or ears. But war isn't an aspect of the primordial human condition. Violence probably is, but war is a state-sponsored institution. It's not an essential truth. And other institutions that have, in their time, appeared impregnable have caved in the face of skepticism and creativity. Think about the divine right of kings or slavery or even 100 years ago, patriarchal assumptions went virtually unchallenged and women were little more than the social and legal property of the men in their lives. I'm not suggesting that we don't need international organizations to supervise borders and boundaries and that we won't need soldiers of some kind. But I think that putting the kind of money and energy into armies at this point is not. I don't think that we can fool ourselves any longer into thinking that it's making even the most privileged of us any safer. It's threatening our collective existence. We're not going to find better ways to solve our international or intertribal disagreements unless we start to ask those questions, unless we really start seriously and honestly to look.
Penny, I just want to thank you again for joining us here today on Active Voice Radio. I think that your book is a really important thing for all of us. So many of us have members of our family that are involved in these conflicts and are wondering about these questions. And for the rest of us out here who don't have a direct connection, who don't have a family member in Iraq or Afghanistan, it's important for us all to understand what our young soldiers are dealing with, because we're going to see them out there, and we want to do something different than happened after Vietnam. We want to give our soldiers a better justice and a better understanding, and this book really helps us do that. Thank you again.
Thank you.